This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Alex Tabarrok. He's an economist at George Mason University. He's a co-founder with Tyler Cowen of the economics blog Marginal Revolution, a textbook writer, a world traveler, and I regret to announce a Canadian, at least by birth. Is that correct, Alex Tabarrok?
That is all correct.
Okay. You're a Canadian by birth, but an American by choice.
That is exactly right.
Okay. And are you an American citizen? I realize this is, you know, it's Trump's America, so I'm leading with the citizenship questions, but.
Yeah, unfortunately, I am a U.S. citizen. Unfortunately, since I've become a citizen, you know, Canada has gone up in the freedom rankings and the United States has gone down.
It's a weird thing. You know, there was in the 70s, 80s and 90s, there were a lot of Canadians coming down here for economic freedom. And I you're not the only Canadian I know who is mad that they traded in, Canuck citizenship for the red, white and blue. But.
Yeah, exactly. When I was in the lineup to become a citizen, the security guard, who I think was not American, says, looked at my passport. He says, "You Canadian, why you want to come to the U.S.?"
Well, today we are going to talk about a fascinating paper that Alex published a few months ago in the journal Economic Policy. Is that right, Alex?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, with Nathan Goldschlag of the Census Bureau. We're going to talk about he spent a long time in India recently. We're going to talk about that in relation to economic regulation and kind of culture. And then also what he thinks about the economic policies of the federal government under Donald J. Trump and the current and possibly short-lived Republican majority. But Alex, thanks for joining the Reason Podcast.
Always great to be here.
Let's start with the paper, which is titled, "Is Regulation to Blame for the Decline in American Entrepreneurship?" And published earlier this year. Now, this has gotten written up in a lot of places because it's a man-bites-dog story, by which I mean it's libertarian economist discovers that federal regulation may not be the main or only, certainly the only reason Americans are starting fewer companies. Basically in the paper, and Alex, correct me when I am wrong, as I surely will be, but basically you start out with the idea or with the fact that over the past several decades, by most measures, people are starting fewer businesses in the United States. And you note that over the same period, you know, essentially regulations on business have gone way, way up, federal regulations. So you and your co-author expected to find a causative relationship, you know, which is all sound kind of free market laissez-faire libertarian economics. If you increase regulations, it helps to explain the decrease in startups, right? I mean, that's kind of the starting point of the paper.
That's exactly right. So I think it's important that we talk a little bit about this decline in dynamism and how it's measured and what it means, because regardless of the results of the paper, I think that in itself is important. And let me just give you a few kind of sound bites on this issue. So the startup rate, the number of new firms, for example, has declined by about 40% since the 1980s. So we're talking about a fairly big decline. Another way of looking at this is that in the 1980s, about half of all firms were young. They were less than 5 years of age. Now, the young firms accounted for a smaller share of employment, but they accounted for about 20% of employment. Today, only about a third of firms are less than 5 years old, and they only account for about 11% of employment. So we often hear that the U.S. population is getting older. It's also true about U.S. firms. U.S. firms are getting older. And this is one of the measures of declining dynamism that we have.
And that's, I mean, you know, that it was funny because as I was reading the paper and I was like, well, you struggle to come up with a kind of comprehensive answer for why we are, starting fewer businesses and they're getting older. And I guess I was hoping at the end that you were going to say, and since we can't really explain it fully, it means it must not be happening. So we don't have to worry about it. It kind of solves itself. But so you have these slower startups. And then the starting point, which makes sense, or one, what you're investigating is, okay, what's the role of federal regulations on that? And what did you find and how did you calculate what the regulations were, because that's, I mean, part of what's, and I say this as a non-economist, it's, you know, the paper is great because it really, it also allows the reader to understand the methods that you're using in pretty, you know, pretty easy to understand prose. So what were the, how did you know what regulations to look at as a possible cause of slowdown in the startup economy?
Sure. Okay, so the theory, as you said, I think is rather plausible. It's that, you know, regulation accumulates over time. And it's not that there's any single regulation that might necessarily, you know, be the cause, but it's like pebbles in the stream. You throw one pebble and, you know, nothing happens. The stream keeps going. You throw another and nothing happens, but you keep throwing pebbles into the stream and eventually you dam the stream up. And so the idea was, let's try and get some measure of the accumulation of regulation over time. And maybe it's this demisclerosis, the buildup of interest groups. This is the Mansur-Olson kind of rise and decline of nations theory. So we wanted to get a measure of regulation. In the past, what people have done is use a pretty crude kind of measure, just sort of count up the number of pages in the Federal Register or in the Code of Federal Regulations. And what the problem with that is, you can only then get one measure for the entire country. It's just a, you know, pure time series. So we wanted something which looked at different amounts of regulation in different industries. And fortunately, two of my colleagues at the Mercatus Center have created this Reg Data database. And what the database does is it looks at the Code of Federal Regulations. And that's the stock of all of the regulations which are in existence at any particular point in time. And using kind of some machine learning techniques, two things happen. They look at each kind of chunk of the Code of Federal Regulation, basically a paragraph. And in each of these parts of the Code of Federal Regulations, they count up the number of regulatory words, which are like words like must, prohibited, shall. And then, and this is where the machine learning part comes in, they associate each part of the Code of Federal Regulations with an industry. So this is a probabilistic measure. It's sort of like, you know, Google or Facebook, they look at a picture and they say, oh, there's a high probability, you know, this is Alex Tabarrok, this is Nick Gillespie, this is a cow, you know, this is a car. So it looks at the Code of Federal Regulations and it looks for words which are associated with industries. Mining, you would associate that with the mining industry, you know, banks and so forth. Okay. So what this means is that for each part of the Code of Federal Regulations, we have the number of restrictive words and the probability that that part is associated with an industry. We sum these up, and that gives us for each industry a measure of how much regulation there is in each year.
Okay.
So that was a little bit long-winded. I apologize.
Okay. So that those are the regulations. So, I mean, we're for the, and certainly for this conversation, we're assuming that this is a better measure of of regulatory growth, and I mean that's what you found though, right? Is that the economy is more regulated now than it was 30 years ago, basically across the board.
Right. So we wanted to test this, and most of the tests we come up with, it kind of satisfies it sort of our intuitions. Mm-hmm. That is, as you said, regulation overall is up. We looked at things like, you know, regulation according to this measure, it's much stronger in the mining and gas industries than it is in the delivery industry. Okay, that's good. It makes sense then. We looked at, again, according to this measure, what are the agencies which regulate the most? And it turns out, according to this measure, that the Environmental Protection Agency regulates the most, the IRS the second most. So again, that's good because it kind of fits with our intuition of what a measure of regulation should look like.
And you did use the it's the EPA, right? It sets the bar for this. They're the 100%. I mean, they're the benchmark, right? For what's a heavy regulator. So
correct. Okay. They're the heaviest regulator.
So okay. So you find, you know, again, this is all complicit. But then, what did you find? What's the connection between increases in regulation and decreases in startups?
Okay. So then we looked at the startup rate, we looked at job creation rate, job disruption rate, and tried to correlate it with measures of regulation by industry, and basically we found nothing. So this is sort of shocking to us.
Okay. Going into it, I am very interested in, there's a bunch of people at George Mason who are doing this. There's other people, I mean, like Deirdre McCloskey, as well as Russ Roberts and whatnot, who are, you know, questioning a lot of not economics, the meaning, you know, the usefulness of economics, but the presumptions or the arrogance of economics. So it's kind of great to see you guys testing the hypothesis rather than just being like, we don't even have to run this test. We already know what the answer is going to be. But how did it feel when you were like, question mark, exclamation point, you know, like cartoon curse bubble, when it didn't pan out?
Right, exactly. So, you know, the first thing, you go back to the data and you say, have I made a mistake? You know, and you double check things. And, you know, then we started basically, you know, throwing everything we could at it in different forms. Like, what if we lagged it? You know, what if it takes some time? Mm-hmm. You know, and we came up with a bunch of different variants. We can talk about those. And basically nothing came up. And the fundamental reason appears to be fairly simple to explain, and that is this. It's that dynamism, as measured by these things we talked about, dynamism, it's down. It's down in highly regulated industries. It's down in lightly regulated industries. It's down in manufacturing. It's down in services. You know, it is down in industries which compete abroad compared to industries which don't compete abroad. So whatever the cause of this decrease in dynamism in the United States, it's got to be something fairly deep and something fundamental, something which affects all kinds of industries.
Can I ask two quick questions? And I'll use Reason, Reason Foundation or Reason Magazine as an example. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. Thank you very much. But you know, when I look back at, even I started at Reason in October of 93, what we did then versus what we do now is radically different. We basically, on the journalism side, we published a monthly magazine and that was it. And, you know, that took all of our time. Now we, you know, we publish a monthly magazine. We publish 3 podcasts a week. We publish a website that puts up hundreds of thousands of words a year. We do events. We do 150 to 250 videos a year. We are about 3 or 4 times bigger, I think, in terms of number of employees on the journalism side. So, you know, we're an older company, and yet we are radically different than what we were. What I'm getting at is, you know, is part of the problem here maybe that that model of looking at startups, it's missing the dynamism within firms that where they're radically, you know, they have radically changed what they're doing and remade themselves 3 or 4 or 5 times over, but you wouldn't know that from the outside.
Yeah, so I think that's a very good point. And there is a problem when we say dynamism. There is a problem when we say dynamism. That automatically sounds like something good, right?
Right.
But think about it as creative destruction. Now, creative destruction, we, you know, in libertarian circles is good.
Yeah.
But, right. But maybe what's going on is what you're saying is that the amount of destruction for an equal or greater amount of creativity has gone down. So maybe it used to be the case that to get a new product, you needed a new firm because the old firms, you know, they had to be killed. And in killing them, you know, that has costs. You've got to move your workers. The workers become unemployed. They have to move to a different firm or a different industry. So maybe now with information technology, the old firms are actually more, you know, agile. They're more able to, you know, keep up with changing demands and figure out, oh, let's ourselves create this new product. So as someone who, you know, himself is getting older, I kind of like this interpretation.
Right, right.
I'm not sure that I can prove it yet, but that is definitely a hypothesis.
I'm thinking in terms of Silicon Valley firms. If you look at Fairchild Semiconductor back in the 50s, where, you know, many of the current kings of Silicon Valley, their businesses, their companies have roots in the breakup of that company, everybody leaving there because of personnel issues, among other things. And then you look at a company like Google or Facebook, where they're absorbing more and more companies. So maybe that might help explain some of this, but then you get to the other question, which is, I mean, the economy is also, and this, I guess, it was my second question, you know, it compared to the 1980s and 1990s, certainly we are seeing slower economic growth annually in the United States, and I think across most of the developed world for sure. So does that suggest then that, you know, I think, Robert Adams, who has talked about at length, as well as other economists, that, you know, the idea that we could take 3% annual economic growth for granted, which we had for a good chunk of the post-war period in the United States and Europe, that's over. And we'll be lucky to be cracking 2% for the foreseeable future, and that some kind of shift has happened where, you know, it's just not coming back.
Yeah, so that's Robert Gordon, and also
Robert Gordon. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, and of course Tyler Cowen. The Great Stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that is correct, and the fact that, you know, productivity growth has kind of declined, and growth has declined at the same time that dynamism has declined, certainly suggests that the decline in dynamism has been a bad thing, but it could also be the case that, you know, multiple things are going on at the same time, and that the decline in growth is, you know, caused by something else.
Is it also possible that we, you know, that the thermometer, the measuring stick that we're using for growth no longer really is keeping up? Because, you know, we're basically the same age, and we can remember periods when people were saying, I'll throw it out there, in the 70s, when I read books by older people, and I guess smarter people than me, they'll talk about the 70s as an economic wasteland. And, you know, there was terrible macroeconomic policy, all kinds of problems. But I know from my own experience as a kid growing up in a lower middle class household, suddenly consumer goods started flooding my shelves in a way that they hadn't before. And I know even in the 21st century, where we're seeing, you know, historically low economic growth, more and more stuff keeps getting better and cheaper and more within reach. So, I mean, how, you know, is it possible that just as we might not be able to gauge the rate of new business innovation, we're also not really able to fully gauge economic growth that translates into higher quality of life for people?
So I think there's a definite trend which is going on, is pretty obvious, is that, you know, the service sector, you know, side of the economy is growing, and the manufacturing or goods producing sector is declining. This has obviously been going on for a long time. So what this means is that precisely because we have become so good at, you know, manufacturing televisions and monitors and, you know, computers, those become a smaller share of the economy. Over time, and kind of in the same way that farming, agriculture became a smaller share of the economy over time. And that means a larger and larger share is dominated by services, but services are kind of almost inherently, it's difficult to increase their productivity, right? This goes back to Baumol's cost disease, is that it takes, you know, for a string quartet, it takes four people an hour, and that was true in 1600, and it's still true today. So as we shift more and more into services, it's sort of natural that measured growth rates at least do decline.
Okay. So here we are then, where, you know, we've gotten to there. What are the other plausible explanations that you run through in the paper for, if it's not federal government regulation that is strangling startups or slowing it down, what are some of the other likely causes or plausible alternative hypotheses?
Right. So it could be state regulation. That seems possible. Particularly, we know that, you know, people are now today, they're less likely to move from state to state and indeed or within a state. And maybe occupational licensing, the growth of occupational licensing has some role in that.
And that we know, for instance, or I suspect we've all read the same factlets that, you know, in 1955 or something, you know, maybe one out of 10 occupations, you needed a license to practice it. Now it might be six or seven or something like that.
Yeah, the number of occupations which require a license has gone way up. And since those licenses are typically governed at the state level, if you've got a license in one state, to go to another state, you go through the whole process again.
Right? Yeah, now that makes sense. I wish we would do that with driving tests. You know, we should have checkpoints at every state. Because I'm recording this 6 miles from the Indiana border in Ohio, and you know they don't know how to drive over there,
exactly.
For God's sake. Okay, so there's state level kind of skunk works going on that might. What else might explain? Can we get to the point where we just admit that people today are lazier and less smart or more satisfied?
I mean, again, you know, my colleague Tyler Cowen's latest book, The Complacent Society, right? The Complacent Class. So who knows? I don't find that a satisfactory answer. But
you do have children, so you know that it's probably true.
Yeah. There's something to that. Though my mother tells me that I wasn't better at that age either. So.
Oh, okay. So, well.
Yeah.
She sounds like a terrible mother. I'm sure your wife is much better.
The problem with the state regulation hypothesis is that at least at the cursory level, it doesn't look, you know, like Texas is booming and California is declining. There's no sort of obvious correlations there. This also appears to be true that the decline in dynamism, it's through Europe as well, maybe even worldwide. We don't really know what's going on in, you know, China or Japan, but in Europe, there's also evidence for declining dynamism. And that suggests, consistent with the Robert Gordon and Tyler Cowen kind of thesis, that it's something about technology. So if technology is itself getting slower, we have fewer new ideas, it makes sense that you're going to have fewer new firms. If each new idea, you know, is an opportunity to create a new firm, fewer ideas, fewer firms. So that's a possibility. It could also be the case that maybe we've outsourced the churn. So I said another word for dynamism is churn. And maybe what's going on is that very cleverly in the United States, we have become the designers of the iPhone, and we have exported all of the manufacturing, okay, to China, which sounds bad. But on the other hand, in China, what this means, Apple is an incredibly cruel taskmaster. So if you do not improve your Gorilla Glass, you do not improve your chip, you don't make it, you know, faster, cheaper, better with each iteration of the iPhone, then you're kicked out, you know, of the Nexus. Apple will go hire another firm in China who is doing it better, cheaper, faster. So maybe some of that dynamism, which we can, again, can also think about it as churn or turnover or, you know, new firms killing old firms. Maybe we've exported some of that to other countries.
Hmm. Where do you end up with this? You write in the paper that it's unsettling or that the decline in dynamism is disturbing or is upsetting. I mean, there are positive signs, you know, parts to it or positive interpretations. But if we are starting fewer companies now, it means we're probably going to have fewer new companies in the future for some of the reasons that you've laid out here. What do you do with this, unexplainable phenomenon, this Gordian knot of, okay, so the economy seems to be less dynamic, but we're not sure why.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'd be much happier if it were regulation, because mm-hmm. then the policy conclusion, cut regulation, you know, would be much simpler.
Right. And this, again, to your intellectual honesty and candor, which I thought was great, you also, you run through explanations for why certain types of regulation might be positive. And you talk about, for instance, changes in healthcare law that would allow healthcare to be portable. That would mean that, somebody who's an entrepreneur but really needs their healthcare has to stick with their job and they can't really start a new company if they are given something, and obviously you're not endorsing Obamacare or something, but like where you can get cheap healthcare regardless of your work status, that could actually liberate the economy, even though it would be brought into being by a regulation.
That's right. And to go back, we were discussing occupational licensing. I think there is an argument to federalize it, which sounds very bad. And maybe it's, only a second best solution rather than getting rid of it altogether. But if we had some more federal control where you could move to any of the 50 states once you were certified in one of them, that I think, again, could
the
be.
The goddamn Canadian, you can take the Canadian out of the great white north. Now, what is hilarious about that, too, is how much veterinary law. There's like huge veterinary stuff that you have to redo when you cross state lines because people living in Oklahoma are totally, or cows living in Oklahoma are totally different than cows living in Texas, as
absolutely
anybody from Texas would be able to tell you. But yeah, it's, so now we're stuck, but do you really get rid of the belief that, regulation as a cost hurts economic growth or possibilities? And I guess let me transition then to your time in India, which is an economy which is gigantic, which is booming in, certainly compared to where it was decades ago. It's more liberalized, but it is still like unbelievably rule-bound and regulated by American standards. Are you ready to say, okay, well, I guess regulation doesn't really matter here?
Yeah, no, not at all. Look, the differences between the United States and India are far, in terms of regulation, are far, far, far bigger than the differences between the United States, in 1990 and the United States today. The United States in 1990 and today both are among the better and less regulated places in the world.
Even as you've noted that the U.S. has tumbled down. But and I guess that's partly the global or indices of economic freedom and whatnot are useful. But it really is kind of the case that the top, 20% 30 countries are really bunched up pretty tightly, all things considered.
That's right. They're 9.8 and 9.9s on a 10-point kind of a scale. Still, I would prefer that, since I'm here, that the U.S. be number one.
I think we're seeing, I'm not sure I can do the regressions on this, but, it's been going downhill since you showed up. So, I think we're seeing a trend here.
Exactly.
But so India is massively regulated, and take it from there.
So India is remarkable because it's massively regulated. The Indian state tries to get its fingers in every single part of society. And yet at the same time, the state in many ways is quite small. They don't have a lot. They have 1/5 the number of government workers per capita than in the United States. So what this means is the amount of corruption and getting around the law is incredibly high in India. So I actually was very comfortable there because this was a place where the public sector, the government sector, is a disaster, but the private sector works extremely well. You can always get things done. And so this was a place where, public choice, I understand this, but the amount of regulation is astounding. To give you like one example, in Mumbai, which is where I spent quite a bit of my time, they put in rent controls in 1949, and basically they did not raise the rents for 50 years.
Wow, that's a bargain.
So, yeah, exactly. So people, even today in Mumbai, people have incredible apartments, you know, very large, capacious apartments. The buildings are falling apart, but the size of the apartments is large, and they are paying $2 a month, you know, when, you know, obviously market rents would be much, much higher than that, but they've been frozen into these rents, which have just stuck for 50 years.
So how does that, and yet the Indian economy is growing better than most of Europe, right?
Well, they have a long way to catch up. You know, when you're stunted and then suddenly you get a little bit of food, you can grow quickly, but they've got a long way. They've got a lot. Well, and in India, of course, it's literal stunting as well as a figurative figure of speech.
Mm-hmm. So how, here's a kind of theoretical question, though. So, you know, you've done a very fact-based, data-intensive look at, okay, how does regulation affect, you know, business growth in, you know, in the United States, and you didn't find anything. You go to India and you see growth, you see terrible regulation, you also see super inefficient regulation so you can get around it. How does an economist, you know, toggle back and forth? Because, you know, and I realize economics wants to be a kind of positive science where it's looking at facts that everybody can agree to and then kind of manipulate them and come up with, you know, this happens because of this, or it doesn't happen because of that. But then you're always kind of, at some point you have to fall back into a, you know, Ludwig von Mises apodictic certainty, don't you? That it's, well, there are certain axioms that we know to be true, because in the absence of data, we're going to have to, you know, we have to make a determination one way or the other. Is there a epistemological dilemma going on in economics these days?
It's definitely the case that we've become much more empirical. In that sense, we don't have to rely upon apodictic certainty as much as we did before, because we can measure more things. So I don't think it's this is really a crisis. More, I think this is an improvement, actually.
Okay.
That before we had to rely on theory, and now we can measure things. This does bring to my mind, though, however, that, you know, as I said, in India, I was very comfortable because as a public choice economist, I understood, you know, why government failure and markets work great and so forth. It was only actually coming back to the United States that I realized this is the oddity, right? The United States is India is normal. The United States is the peculiarity. And that even given all of the criticisms, which I and you and many others have, of U.S. policy, it's still an incredibly amazing place to live, and it works really remarkably well. Like, government here actually works, you know, better than to be expected. We ought to fear that means we can get much, much worse. So we ought to fear that.
Yeah. Do you want to live in a world where government technically kind of rules everything, but it's really bad at it? So you can just kind of walk around it and, you know, it's a guard that's constantly falling asleep? Or do you want to live in a world where there are fewer rules, but they are much more kind of ruthlessly or programmatically enforced? Because I could see from a libertarian point of view, you know, I think I prefer the second, because I like the predictability and the idea that, you know, there's a common set of rules and then we can just get on with our lives.
Exactly. And that seems to be the lesson of India versus the United States, that a strong limited state, you know, is better than a weak state which tries to control everything, right?
So I want to bring this into a discussion of contemporary America, you know, under Donald Trump and his moves towards deregulation, which are, you know, pretty interesting. And but before we get to that, let me ask you this. How did you get interested in libertarian thought and economics? So your PhD is from George Mason.
Correct.
Did you show up there, thinking that you were going to George Washington University, but you were from Canada, so you speak a completely different language, and you got turned around on the metro? Or were you already a hard, fast libertarian? And, how did you become the intellectual that you are?
As usual with these things, it all begins with Ayn Rand.
You have been waiting to say that your entire life, haven't you?
Exactly. Yes. And so, yeah, of course, I read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and, became the Alex B. Keaton of the time, right? If you remember that, that was my
era. How did you find The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged? Did you come from a political family or a libertarian family, or a schoolmaster in Canada?
No, I didn't come from a libertarian family, but I came from a family where my father would come home with the question of the day, and we would argue about it at the kitchen table. And my friends would often come to my house and were always very surprised that they would be invited to participate in conversations and debate and would actually be listened to. Mm-hmm. And one of the debates one day was what was the value of rock and roll relative to, classical music? And I was taking the position of rock and roll.
So this isn't Alex B. Keaton. This is Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future.
Right.
With rock and roll. I have to ask, given the Canadian connection then, were you also a Rush fan?
Exactly. Given
they had their Ayn Rand phase that I think they have excoriated. But so did you win the debate against your father that rock and roll is, Beatlemania is better than Listomania or something?
I don't think I necessarily won, but I did mention, Rush and Ayn Rand. And my mother said, you would probably like her. And I think she regrets saying that to this day, because that started it all, that I then went out to actually read some novels.
So I say this as somebody who I sadly became libertarian mostly by reading Reason magazine in high school and then stumbling across Free to Choose. But Rand, I didn't quite encounter her until much later, and I was already set in my ways. But how do you go from Ayn Rand to libertarianism? Because she seems to have nothing but contempt for libertarians, the hippies of the right, she called us once. And a lot of objectivists seem really kind of tired of libertarians. Like, we're like Prometheus who goes up and steals not the full fire, but, like a little Bic lighter of fire from the gods, and then are playing with it down in our world. How do you get from Rand to libertarianism?
So Rand, recommended Ludwig von Mises as the greatest economist. And so I started reading Mises, and from Mises, I read Rothbard, and Rothbard, I then, started going to these summer seminars.
Oh, I thought you were going to say David Duke rallies.
Yeah, no. Well, see, this was before I was really reluctant to say that because I didn't want precisely this direction of the conversation.
So you got Rothbard when he was only attacking other libertarians, right?
It was, I met him a few times, and he was a wonderful person to meet. Always he was interesting because the other professors would get up at 9 or 10 in the morning and give their lectures, and Murray wouldn't get up until 2 or 3, and then he would be up at 1, 2, 3 in the morning, and so you could talk with him one on one. And that really was an exciting time in my life.
Were these Institute for Humane Studies seminars or fee, or what groups were you going to?
Yeah, exactly. The Mises Institute, but also IHS, Institute for Humane Studies. I remember Institute for Humane Studies, I went one year, and at the end of the seminar, this is still true today, but this is particularly exciting at this time. At the end of the seminar, you went into a room which was laid out with books. right? And they said, choose any book that you want, any books that you want, take them home with you. Yeah. And this is like the most exciting thing in my life. This is incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that is, I mean, it's like a kid in a candy store, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this was a candy store when it was the only candy store in town that we didn't have the internet, right?
Right.
So libertarianism today is a much more internet-driven phenomena. Mm-hmm. But then there were these obscure books, and you didn't find out about them from your professors. So you were, this was this kind of secret, the Laissez-faire book catalog was the secret treasure trove.
It was a window onto a totally different world that was, I suspect we have the same feelings about it. It was, you know, foreign and exotic and alluring, and it had the ring of truth to it. I was desperate to, I know what you mean. I went to a couple of things where you get books for free. That's like, you know, wow, that's mother's milk.
Exactly.
So to come back to contemporary America now, Donald Trump, boy, what a hard ending, right? I'm sorry. I really should have taken us out of that a little bit more slowly. I just got the bends. It's like coming up from deep underwater. But in Donald Trump, you know, one of the things that he ran on and he has delivered on in certain real ways is being a deregulator. He, things like net neutrality, the people he's put in at the FCC, the FDA, the EPA, the Department of Education. He has rolled back regulations that are under the provenance or control of a lot of federal agencies. He's helped and he's worked with the Congress to kind of push through certain things. On the other hand, he is also ratcheting up regulations when it comes to things like immigration, when it comes to labor. He's pushing E-Verify, which will force every employer in the country essentially to run a papers check on workers. He's putting in, you know, all of these trade barriers, which are incredibly complex and are clearly the type of regulation that hurts businesses. Do you expect, I mean, given what you found in the paper, what you experienced both, you know, in North America as well as India and elsewhere, do you expect Trump's deregulatory moves to have much of an impact one way or the other on the economy?
So I think the biggest one is probably negative, and that is immigration, as you mentioned, because one thing we know for sure is that immigrants are much more likely to start firms. So they actually, this ties back to our earlier discussion on dynamism, because, and it also ties in with India, because when you're in a developing country like India, many, many more people work for themselves because they have to, because they don't have the luxury of working for a, you know, big corporation, because big corporations, they hardly even exist. So people in developing countries, they work for themselves. And when they immigrate to the United States, it's not foreign to them to be an entrepreneur, to start a firm. That's what they're used to. That's how most people get jobs in the developing world. So both on the low-skill immigration side, and on the high-skill immigration side, the fact that we are sending people back who have come here and got an education, and then we're saying, okay, now we've trained you, we've given you this high-tech education, we don't want you here anymore.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. I know some academics who are in, actually in all sorts of disciplines who are department heads, and they're saying, you know, in a lot of fields, the best talent is overseas, or they're, you know, grad students as well as professors you want to pull in. And, you know, you can't, you know, a university is totally travels on the brains of its faculty. And if you're saying we can't, you know, a lot of foreign people don't want to come here because they don't know if they're going to be able to stay or what the immigration status is. It really seems like a very quick way to undermine the superiority of American universities.
Absolutely. And the world, look, there's all kinds of issues with the cost of globalization and, you know, the Rust Belt, and, you know, there are transition costs and costs of trade and so forth. But let's face it, the world is not going to become less globalized. All of the technology is continuing to push in terms of a better connected, more connected world. So for us at this point in time to go to say, no, we're going to stand astride the world and say, stop, I'm sorry, we're going to be the ones who are crushed, not the ones who actually stop globalization.
Do you, you know, as an immigrant, I mean, it's interesting to think my grandparents were immigrants, but wouldn't it, and in a way, obviously, it would be exciting, but wouldn't it kill you if your children, you know, that their best hope for a really interesting, vibrant, prosperous, free future meant that they had to leave their home country?
Yeah, it would be upsetting, right? Because the whole point.
I mean, Grant, depending on the day of the week, that could be the greatest thing that I could dream of happening. And depending on what my kids have done. But no, I mean, it's kind of daunting. And do you think Americans have, it's curious, you coming here by choice, and I mean, you can joke about it, but it's like, you know, you didn't come here for America to become a kind of second rate country. But do Americans understand that, you know, we have to compete with the world, and that we're not going to compete by putting up, more walls and more protection?
Yeah, it is kind of disturbing. I was coming from Canada, not like I was coming from, you know, behind the Iron Curtain or from a terribly poor country. But I do feel that the United States has become or is becoming sort of second rate. And it's worrying. I'm not sure what to say about that.
Well, we should try and come up with, I don't know why I feel a need to end on a high note, but, rather than ending on a note like, yes, we're becoming second rate and I don't know what else to say. It is a beautiful spring day as we're recording this. What areas do you see as most, let me put it this way. Do you think Trump, who, you know, won with a minority of the popular vote, and I don't mean that to delegitimize his win, he won fair and square and all of that, but do you think that his mentality, which is simultaneously kind of bragging that America is the greatest, and he wants to make America great again, but then he seems to be pursuing policies that are working at odds with that, is that representative of where we are as a country, kind of our public psychology, or is that off guard? Or do you see the green shoots of like the next kind of not American Revolution, but renaissance of, you know, where we, you know, start to maybe take ourselves a little less seriously and get more in the game and actually be recognize that globalization might mean that America is not going to win every Olympic basketball medal, but it also means we're going to be richer, we're going to be better, we're going to be freer, and everybody else is too.
Yeah, I think the big advantage America has in that score is federalism and decentralization. So I see a lot of dynamism at the city level. You know, cities are really becoming we're almost going back to a time when cities rather than states were the centers of economic activity and were the centers of loyalty and so forth. And I see a huge amount of dynamism at the city level. We certainly have problems with land use policy in the United States, making it very expensive to build. We need, look, the one thing that Donald Trump could have done and should have done as a developer is say, we need to build more. We need to build, right? And I don't see that coming from the national level, but I'm really quite optimistic about the push in California, for example, mm-hmm. at the state level to overcome some of these not in my backyard local rulings, which are stopping property rights, which are stopping development.
Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, I guess this all kind of works in, you know, it's a pendulum or a balancing act or whatever. But then in some places like Texas and Florida, which had been very open to kind of wide open development, you're starting to see, depending on the place, a lot of NIMBYism where they're like, oh, no, we've got enough here. So I guess it's kind of an ebb and flow. But I agree, that's an interesting way to think about stuff. And certainly looking at, kind of the decentralization back to regional or, urban centers as like meaningful places of identity and community is a place to look for hope.
Exactly right. And charter schools is another example, which mm-hmm. I think have done really well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating to see how, the chipping away at these giant organizations known as school districts into smaller kind of autonomous units or something. We will leave it there. I have been talking with Alex Tabarrok. He's the economist, George Mason University economist, a co-founder of the Marginal Revolution blog, textbook writer, Canadian, all around, bon vivant. Thank you so much for talking with us, Alex.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.